The House comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of the Honourable Leader of the Opposition.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. This question is to the Prime Minister. Does she stand by all of her government statements and actions?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. In acknowledgement of New Zealand Sign Language this week. Yes, Mr Speaker, in particular our announcement today for pay parity for early learning teachers. The Minister announced today that Budget 2021 will see funding of $170 million over 4 years to help deliver pay parity. This builds on the $151.1 million provided for improving teacher pay in Budget 2020.
Right.
This will see certified teachers on the lowest pay in early education and care services take another large step towards pay parity with their equivalents in kindergartens.
Right.
These changes will address difficulties with recruitment and we hope reduce turnover in education and care services, enabling teachers to provide the consistent and secure relationships children need. Mr Speaker, this is an important part of our economic recovery plan. Further shows our commitment to addressing inequality by delivering salary increases to lower paid workers and supporting pay parity while carefully managing our way through the impact of COVID-19 on the economy, the books and on our people.
When she told media on Monday that she plans to have public engagement on their Hea Puapua report, when will that public engagement take place and what form will it take?
Mr Speaker, actually this is the very issue itself that ministers are yet to consider, but that is why Hea Puapua were asked to come together and to provide not only their expert opinion on the delivery of UNDRIP within New Zealand, but actually how we as a government should engage with the people of New Zealand in responding. I hear the members' call for a timeline on that, and whilst I can't provide that today, I can tell you it will not take the 9 years that it took National.
That's right.
Does she endorse her Minister for Māori Development statement last night that he would first talk to Māori to, quote, see where they see things are going, particularly in terms of the Constitution? We want to get their view and then we want the public's on where we go in terms of partnership, end quote.
Mr Speaker, I would be very surprised if, had the National Government fulfilled its commitment in its Cabinet Minute in 2014 to set up a pathway to fulfilling the declaration, I would have been very surprised if that did not involve engagement with Māori.
Yeah, that's right.
Because after all, it was meant to be about a pathway to seeing the declaration lived up to within New Zealand, and it is a declaration on the rights of Indigenous people. So somehow the idea that you wouldn't talk to Māori about that seems slightly farcical to me.
Does she in any way accept the view in Hea Puapua that New Zealand has two spheres of governance, the Kaiwanatanga sphere that represents the Crown and the Rangatiratanga sphere that reflects Māori?
Mr Speaker, I see that as a reflection of the basic principles of the Treaty of Waitangi that's being reflected there by the members of Hea Puapua. However, Mr Speaker, again, you know, I come back to this very simple premise that we spoke about a little bit in the House yesterday. It is 2021.
That's right.
You know, in my view, Mr Speaker, I think New Zealand generally accepts that we have a relationship between the Crown and Māori that does make us unique. I don't think we should be afraid about seeing further progress in the way that we build and improve that relationship. My question to the National Party would be, you seemed willing to see that progress in government. You seem wholly unwilling from opposition.
Is this dual government model what her Minister for Māori Crown Relations was referring to yesterday when he asked her if she agreed with the, quote, the comments made at the Iwi Chairs Forum in Porirua on Friday that when Kaiwanatanga and Rangatiratanga work together in partnership, we'll see great things happening, end quote.
Mr Speaker, I see that all that the member for Māori Crown Relations was reflecting are the three principles of the Treaty of Waitangi.
Debbie Nairua Picker.
Can, to the Prime Minister, Can you please give your view on whether the Leader of the Opposition's continued attack on Māori is racist?
Yeah. There's a couple of things about that question, and one of them is the U in it, and the other is, I think, asking for a view on a matter which is well outside the Prime Minister's responsibility.
Does she agree with former Prime Minister David Longhi, who stated that, quote, democratic government can accommodate Māori political aspiration in many ways? What it cannot do is acknowledge the existence of a separate sovereignty. As soon as it does, it isn't a democracy, end quote.
The Speaker, I have no doubt that if David Longhi had the ability to remark on what we are doing as a government in the area, for instance, of health reform, he would applaud it. The member, what the member characterises as separatism, I characterise as partnership. And Mr. Speaker, it is just unacceptable, I would hope, for any member in this House to stand by while we have a health system or systems across the board, Mr. Speaker, that lead to different outcomes for different people in New Zealand. Our job as government is to make sure that we see opportunity and the potential of all New Zealanders realised, and our current systems do not always achieve that.
A point of order, Rauri Waititi.
Mr. Speaker, I seek your guidance and advice. Over the past 2 weeks, there has been racist propaganda and rhetoric towards tangata whenua. That not only is insulting to tangata whenua, but diminishes the mana of this House.
Yeah, I thank the member for his point of order. I think relatively ineloquently made comments in this area last week, and that is that we are a House of Representatives, that there are a broad range of views within the House, and part of my responsibility is to allow those views to be aired. Many things in the time that I've been a Member of Parliament have resulted in discomfort to other members because the views are very different, and there are almost certainly some views that were expressed earlier in my career that would now be regarded as out of order for the reasons that the member has expressed. In my view, we are not at that point now.
Supplementary. Is it her...
I am going to warn the member that... No, the member will sit down when I stand up. I am going to warn the member that litigation or re-litigation of points of order or decisions on points of order is in itself disorderly. And now that the member has been warned, it would make it deliberately disorderly. So I'm asking the member to make sure that if he has a point of order, it is a fresh and different one. Rauri Waititi.
Fresh and different point of order, Mr. Speaker. When it comes to views of Indigenous rights and Indigenous peoples, those views must be from those Indigenous peoples for the Indigenous rights of our people. That can't be determined by people who are not Indigenous. So what I am asking Ihikama to this House, tēnā koe te piri mea, is that if we find this attitude acceptable in this House, the constant barrage of insults to tangata whenua, then I find this House in disrepute. And
order. Order, order. Order. The member's mic's off, so he will resume his seat.
Hey, we
Order. The member will now leave the chamber.
Mr. Speaker, to the Prime Minister, is it her government's position, that Article 2 of the Treaty is exercised within the Crown's right to govern, as in the Cabinet Circular, or in partnership with the Crown, as her government is now stating?
Mr. Speaker, I absolutely stand by the manifestation of the idea of partnership in the way that we are reforming the health system. And Mr. Speaker, there has been sentiment from the National Party when they were in government that suggested they viewed these matters the same way. That's right. Yeah. I note that the document that was part of the Māori health strategy released under the last National Government, He Korowai Oranga, states enabling whānau, hapū, iwi and Māori to exercise control over their own health and wellbeing, as well as the direction and shape of their own institutions, communities and development as a people, is a key thread of He Korowai Oranga. Mr. Speaker, again, as I've said, we as a nation have been making progress. There is a lot of work to be done. I would encourage the National Party to return to the position they once held of the idea of partnership, because I see this as a lead from the Leader of the Opposition that is fundamentally taking us backwards.
Order. Order. I'd just like to ask the Honourable Gerry Brownie to stop coaching me. Thank you.
Supplementary to the Prime Minister. Does she agree with Hea Puapua that our current government does not reflect the treaty, and that honouring the treaty requires a rebalancing of the Crown and Māori spheres of governance?
Mr. Speaker, again, a demonstration that this was a report, a group that we brought together to provide us with ideas, advice and their views. It was not a government report. As that statement it then demonstrates, a member cannot have it both ways. I'll say again what I said last week. We have not yet considered the report, including the views that sit within it.
Question number two, Shannon Halbert.
Tēnā koe, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Infrastructure, what recent reports has he seen on infrastructure?
Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker, securing the economic recovery in New Zealand is being supported by the government's commitment to building infrastructure for the betterment of New Zealanders' lives. Today, Te Waihanga, the Infrastructure Commission, has released its consultation document, He Tuapapa Ki Te Ora, Infrastructure for a Better Future. This is the legislated requirement that the government created last term for the Infrastructure Commission to produce a 30-year strategy to help meet our infrastructure needs. The government is committed to tackling the long-term challenges facing New Zealand and laying the foundations for a prosperous future.
Three. Why is an infrastructure strategy required?
Speaker, there are lots of organisations who plan and deliver infrastructure, whether it's roads, power lines or hospitals, but there is no one organisation that looks across all sectors at our needs and the issues that we face. What the consultation document highlights is the scale of New Zealand's infrastructure deficit that has been built up over many decades. This government has committed $49.8 billion in infrastructure, but even with that, we recognise that there is more to do and it must include a more strategic approach. The strategy will help identify what is holding us back and look at the system that leads to the infrastructure we need to build a better New Zealand for everyone.
Supplementary. What is the process for the finalisation of the infrastructure strategy?
Mr. Speaker, decisions we make about our infrastructure can affect us for decades or even centuries. Some of the problems we have now, such as difficulties with water pipes around cities such as Wellington, congestion in our cities or unaffordable homes, are the result of decisions made in the past. The document is a step towards a better future. It sets out the challenges we're facing and proposes solutions. Te Waihanga is now asking New Zealanders what they think. Consultation is open for 6 weeks, and from this feedback, a 30-year strategy for New Zealand's infrastructure will be developed and published in September.
Question number three, Chloe Sforrett.
To the Associate Minister of Housing, Public Housing, is she aware that nearly all commercial lease agreements include transparent criteria for rent reviews? If so, will she consider requiring residential tenancy agreements to include agreed criteria for rent increases?
Honourable Porter Williams.
No e e Māori, Mr Speaker. Mr Speaker, while I have no responsibility for commercial leases which sit under the Justice portfolio, I am advised that there is nothing in law requiring the rent increase criteria in commercial leases the member has asked about. Rather, these are often negotiated as part of a commercial rent agreement that typically covers a much longer period than a residential rent agreement, usually 5 to 10 years. This government has already made changes to encourage longer-term residential rent agreements, including removing no-cause terminations, limiting rent increases to once a year. We know that if rental agreements can be agreed over a longer term, it is more likely that these types of agreements would be made between landlords and tenants, if they so wish.
Do any of the things that the Minister has just listed actually limit the amount that landlords can raise rents by, or give renters any certainty about what their rent will be next year?
Mr Speaker, what I can say is that we have made multiple changes to improve the security and rights of renters, including limiting rent increases to once a year and banning rental bidding. We are monitoring what happens with rent rises and will take action if necessary.
Would she prefer a system like in Ireland and Scotland, where an independent government agency sets maximum rent increases each year, or a system where renters and landlords negotiate maximum annual rent increases collectively, like in Sweden?
Mr Speaker, I can't speak to what happens in other jurisdictions. All I can speak to is our aspiration for renters in New Zealand to be in homes that are warm, dry and affordable. And what I can speak to also is our program to support renters to have much more ability to deal with the issues that confront them, and to be able to deal with them in a way that gives them certainty and power. If a tenant thinks that their rent is too expensive and not in line with the market, they have the opportunity of going to the tenancy tribunal.
Does the government's current practice of collecting rent data when bonds are lodged for new tenancies, but not when landlords increase rents during the course of a tenancy, provide an accurate picture of whether rent increases are fair and affordable?
Mr Speaker, my view is that the information that HUD uses, which is Stats New Zealand Rental Price Index, is a much more accurate and complete view of rent changes and prices.
Will the government consider restricting rent increases to match the restrictions on wage increases for nurses, teachers and social workers?
Mr Speaker, what the government will consider is continuing the work we are doing to ensure that we improve the security and rights of renters and tenants by limiting rent increases to once a year and banning rental bidding.
Question number 4, Angela Roberts.
To the Minister of Education, what is the government doing to address wage inequality amongst early childhood education teachers?
The Honourable Chris Hopkins.
Mr Speaker, today I announce that qualified and registered teachers on the lowest pay in early learning, education and care services will take another leap towards pay parity with their equivalents in kindergartens. Pay parity for education and care teachers is a manifesto commitment for this government. It's also reflected in the Early Learning Action Plan. It will address the obvious gap that has emerged between teachers in early education, childcare centres and their equivalents in kindergartens. We started progress last year by lifting the minimum levels of pay, and we'll be continuing to work towards that over this term of government.
Supplementary. Why is it important for the government to address early childhood education pay parity?
Mr Speaker, the government believes it's only fair that teachers with the same qualifications, carrying out the same work and with equal degrees of experience should be paid comparably. That has not been the case.
Over the 9 years before the government took office, the pay increases that went to kindergarten teachers were not passed on to teachers working in other forms of early learning. That has created a significant wage gap in that area. That is one of the things the government wants to be able to address. We are committed to lifting the income levels of those lower paid workers, whilst also dealing with significant issues like pay equity and pay parity, and today's announcement is further evidence of that.
Excellent.
Supplementary, what does today's announcement specifically do to ensure pay increases for teachers at education and care centres?
Mr Speaker, today's announcement does two things. First and most immediately, from the 1st of July, it increases the funding rates for education and care services to ensure that the next increase for kindergarten teacher pay, which kicks in this year, will flow through to education and care services. The second thing that it does is introduce new higher rates of funding from the 1st of January 2022 for the services that agree to pay their teachers up to the equivalent of Step 6 on the kindergarten teacher salary scale, meaning a teacher in early learning and care services that have 6 years worth of experience should be being paid step six on the kindergarten teacher's salary scale. That's a significant change, and it could see some early learning teachers get pay increases of up to 17%.
Wow, that's excellent.
Question number five, Andrew Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Infrastructure. How many shovel-ready infrastructure projects have not yet begun construction, and what is the total number of shovel-ready projects?
Mr. Speaker, as I have said to the member in previous replies on this question, we're making good progress. The very latest I'm able to tell him in the House is, as at the 31st of March, 115 IRG projects have started construction. That's an increase of 48 projects during the month of March. 106 IRG projects have pre-construction work underway, such as consenting, design and procurement. And there are 10 projects that are still undergoing due diligence or other contracting activity. The total number of IRG projects that has been approved is 231. I would note for the member that this has shifted around a little bit, as some larger programs have been broken into smaller projects for ease of procurement and contracting.
What is the Minister's definition of shovel-ready, given the large number of projects he listed a year ago as shovel-ready have no shovels in the ground?
Mr. Speaker, as we've discussed previously in the House, when this work was first undertaken in April last year, the statement made in the Cabinet paper that's been released was that projects should be ready to go or near ready to go within 6 months. By the time we came to finalise the projects, the construction environment was very different, the COVID environment was very different, Cabinet had progressed its thinking, and 12 months was seen to be a more appropriate timeframe.
How many shovel-ready projects have been completed?
Mr. Speaker, I would need to get back to the member on that. But all of the projects were significant projects that were required to be done in communities. The member shouldn't concern himself too much with that number at this point, because the projects are contributing significantly to regional development and will do so for some time.
How many shovel-ready projects are not expected to proceed?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the only projects that are happening are the ones that have been contracted, and that is the 231 that I mentioned before. There may be more. As I said, we've got the 10 projects that are still going through due diligence.
The order, Mr. Speaker. I asked the Minister how many shovel-ready projects are expected not to proceed. I don't think he addressed that issue.
Well, the issue was certainly addressed.
Was it?
Question number six.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Speaker.
A further supplementary?
Yes, please. Does he anticipate, in his role as Minister for Infrastructure, receiving a letter from the Deputy Prime Minister and Minister in charge of the Implementation Unit regarding his failure to deliver shovel-ready projects?
Speaker, when the Deputy Prime Minister and the Minister of Infrastructure commune, it's a true meeting of minds. I'm sure at some point they will talk to one another. One of the things they might talk about are the excellent projects taking place in, for example, the Port Waikato electorate, where the Sunset Beach Community Hub and Lifeguard Facility project's underway, the Lake Kamiaha project is underway. What the Deputy Prime Minister and the Minister for Infrastructure might discuss is the fact that the local member doesn't seem to support these important community projects.
Question number six, Dr. Emily Henderson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is for the Minister of Health. What recent announcements has he made about new hospital facilities in Northland?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Andrew Little.
Mr. Speaker, on Friday I had the privilege of opening two new operating theatres and a cardiac catheter laboratory at Whangarei Hospital. The cardiac catheter laboratory is expected to treat around 1,000 patients a year, and the two new operating theatres bring the total number at Whangarei Hospital to 8. I also announced the government's commitment to see out phase 2 of the Northland DHB Critical Capacity and Compliance Stage 2 project that will address the shortage of inpatient bed capacity and see the accreditation of a laboratory. This is a significant investment into Whangarei Hospital after 9 long years of underfunding.
Supplementary, Mr. Speaker. What will these new facilities mean for the people of Te Tai Tokoro?
Mr. Speaker, Northlanders will no longer necessarily have to go to Auckland for life-saving heart procedures like angiograms, angioplasty and the insertion of pacemakers. These new facilities mean that Northlanders can be treated closer to home and closer to whānau. This will benefit those 1,000 people I talked about in the answer to the primary question, but this will also alleviate pressure of the three Auckland DHBs to whom those patients would otherwise be referred.
Supplementary, Mr. Speaker. What other investments are being made for healthcare facilities for people living in Te Tai Tokoro?
Mr. Speaker, other projects approved for this region so far include the Bay of Islands Hospital redevelopment, the Kaitaia Hospital remediation, a linear accelerator bunker and equipment at Whangarei Hospital to provide radiation treatment for people with cancer, and buses to provide mobile surgical and lithotripsy services.
Question number seven, the Honourable Louise Upston.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and Employment and asks, does she have confidence that every single recipient of the Emergency Housing Special Needs Grant is staying in safe and humane accommodation?
The Honourable Carmel Cipollone.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Nuia E Modi. And Mr. Speaker, I'm confident that the vast majority in receipt of an Emergency Housing Special Needs Grant are in appropriate and safe accommodation. But where people feel they aren't safe, I do encourage them to contact the Ministry of Social Development.
Great. Is the reason she had to tell MSD in Rotorua, quote, let's stop using altogether, unquote, certain motels, because after 4 years, the Minister has failed to establish any processes to ensure motels are suitable for people to live in?
4 years. Mr. Speaker, I just want to remind that member that the Emergency Housing Special Needs Grant was actually established under the previous National Government in response to a homelessness program, a problem that had been largely ignored. And many of the developments that have taken place since that special needs grant was first established, have seen improvements like a navigational service to support those in emergency accommodation to access other social supports they might need, housing brokers that we put in place that weren't in place previously to support people to be able to negotiate other housing, to find other housing outside of emergency accommodation. Mr. Speaker, it is not ideal having New Zealand families in emergency accommodation, but it is a failure of previous governments to invest in housing that has led us to the situation.
Is the reason a mother with four children had to stay in a motel for 8 months, surrounded by gang members and violence, because after 4 years she has failed to establish any process that would tell MSD who is staying where?
Mr. Speaker, the vast majority of people who are in emergency accommodation that where they receive an emergency housing grant are actually able to move out of that emergency housing within 6 months. There are others that have more complex issues that make it harder to be able to put them in more secure housing, What I do acknowledge is that in some instances, people have come forward and said that they don't think that the emergency accommodation that they are in is appropriate for them, and that is where MSD will support them to move to something more suitable, Mr Speaker. I'll also note that recently there was a story on Manners Wellington's emergency housing motel, and the people that were interviewed there said that it wasn't an issue with the people that were in the emergency accommodation. They felt safe. It was the people they saw out on the street who were not in accommodation.
The Honourable Dr Megan Woods.
Can the Minister confirm that officials from the Ministry of Social Development have been on the ground in Rotorua with fellow officials from the Ministry of Housing and Urban Development, officers from Rotorua Lakes District Council and representatives of iwi working on long-term solutions, because we are part of a government that is committed to finding solutions to homelessness?
I can absolutely confirm that that is the case, Mr Speaker. As I said, we inherited a housing problem, Mr Speaker. We need to ensure that all of the relevant government agencies, ministers, local government, iwi, are working together to ensure we have long-term solutions, and that work is certainly happening, Mr Speaker.
Can she provide an assurance to families who currently have nowhere to stay and might approach MSD that she will urgently implement a system that will prevent children from being put next to recently released prisoners and gang members?
Mr Speaker, I can go further than that. I can assure people who go to MSD who are homeless and have nowhere else to stay that MSD, under our watch, will support them to get into emergency accommodation so that they don't need to live in their cars or on the streets.
By what date will the Minister commit to stop putting children in motels?
Speaker, as I've already said, our government takes the need to meet the housing demand in this country seriously. We only wish that previous governments had spent time building houses instead of selling them off, Mr Speaker. So we are working at pace. We have committed to 18,400 new public housing and transitional housing places within 4 years, Mr Speaker. And Mr Speaker, that is a darn sight better than what the previous national government did.
Question number 9, Chris Bishop.
Thank you, Mr
Speaker. Oh, sorry. I apologise. Question number 8, Tangi Utekere.
No e e Māori. Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Building and Construction. What recent reports has she seen regarding building consents?
Kia ora, no e Māori, Mr Speaker. Mr Speaker, I've seen a report from Statistics New Zealand that shows that a record 41,028 new homes have been consented in the year ending March 2021, an all-time high. In March 2021 alone, 4,128 new homes were consented, the highest number since the 1940s. A decade ago, the annual number of new homes consented was 14,611. 10 years on, the annual number of new homes consented has risen by 181%. Mr Speaker, these figures show the government's commitment to responding to increased housing demand is delivering the warm, dry, safe and durable houses that New Zealand needs.
What does the Statistics New Zealand data show for regional New Zealand?
Mr Speaker, while the data shows the annual number of new homes consented in Auckland is at a record 17,495, we've also seen record numbers of new homes consented in the regions including Waikato, Hawke's Bay, Taranaki, Manawatu, Whanganui and Tasman.
How is the government supporting the building and construction sector to build on this growth in consents?
Mr Speaker, as a government, we are committed to supporting the sector through continued investment in trades, training and apprenticeships, our building legislative reform program and improvement to our planning system by repealing and replacing the RMA.
We are also ensuring that we have capacity to meet the increased demand through construction skills action plan initiatives. More than 9,300 people have taken up education or employment opportunities in the construction sector since 2018.
Question number nine, Chris Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister for COVID-19 response, does he agree with the Prime Minister who said yesterday, quote, in part, that is because, yes, we really were at the front of the pack in terms of securing agreements with companies for the delivery of vaccine, end quote, and is he satisfied with the COVID-19 vaccine rollout?
Honourable Chris Hopkins.
Mr. Speaker, yes, the Prime Minister is absolutely correct yesterday when she signalled that our objective of keeping New Zealanders safe from COVID-19 was a key factor in securing a diverse vaccine portfolio last year so that we can ensure that everyone in New Zealand is able to get a free vaccination. In relation to the second part of the member's question, again, yes. As of midnight last night, we have so far delivered 388,877 doses of the vaccine across New Zealand. That's an increase of 83,000 on this time last week. DHBs are generally tracking ahead of their national rollout plans. Progress continues in the lead-up to the nationwide rollout of the vaccine to most New Zealanders from July onwards.
Supplementary. Why was a pre-booked 81-year-old turned away from her appointment in Auckland yesterday? And is it acceptable that seniors are being turned away when turning up on time for their pre-booked appointments?
Mr. Speaker, in answer to the second part of the question, no. My understanding is that in that particular case, that vaccination clinic was taking a mix of bookings and walk-in people coming in without appointments. They had more people walking in without appointments, which meant that they became congested. I understand there was a health and safety issue, and so they closed the centre for a short period of time, and the woman concerned was affected by that. I think that is very regrettable. It is something that I know the people doing the vaccines work hard to avoid, and I'm sure that they will have learned from that experience.
Why was a border worker in Rotorua told they had to travel to Tauranga to get a COVID-19 vaccine and that there wasn't a vaccination centre in Rotorua when in fact there is?
Well, I think the last part of the member's question probably answers the first part of his question, which is they were clearly being given wrong information. Without knowing who gave them that information, it's very difficult to comment.
Why were pre-booked people told that the East Tamaki Vaccination Centre had run out of COVID-19 vaccine doses last Thursday when it had not, forcing people to book in for their vaccine appointments again?
Mr. Speaker, I don't have responsibility for what all 5 million New Zealanders say to other New Zealanders around the availability of vaccines.
Question number 10, Ingrid Leary.
Foyaxia, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Pacific Peoples and asks, what recent announcement has he made in supporting Pacific languages in New Zealand?
The Honourable Opito William Seal.
Mr. Speaker, no ia e Māori. It is with immense pride that I stood with the Rotuman community and the Hata Collective on Sunday at the Auckland Museum to mark the launch of Rotuman Language Week, the first of 9 Pacific Language Weeks this year. This year's Rotuman Language Week theme is Te Turuhak Ne Maorerei, or in English, the four pillars of life, including health, whakata, spiritual, whakwhoro, physical, osahei, psychological, and haikainangangana, relationship with people. Te Turuhak Ne Maorerei reminds us that Pacific resilience is about more than just physical health. We must also nurture the other aspects that make up our entire beings. This recognises that for Pacific, language, culture and identity is the cornerstone of our well-being.
Why is it important to celebrate Rotuman Language Week?
Mr. Speaker, Pacific languages, cultures and identity are essential to the health and well-being of Pacific peoples in Aotearoa New Zealand. Language is fundamental to providing Pacific peoples with an anchor to their identity, confidence and safety as we navigate our way through the economic and social challenges ahead post the COVID-19 pandemic. The Rotuman language has been identified as vulnerable on UNESCO's list of endangered languages. The 2019 wellbeing budget provided $20 million over 4 years toward the support of Pacific languages and cultures. This will fund initiatives critical to increasing the use and value of Pacific languages.
What type of support is there for Pacific languages?
Mr. Speaker, the Pacific Language Week have extended activities throughout the year with language funding support provided by the Ministry for Pacific Peoples to enable year-long language learning initiatives which are led by our Pacific communities throughout Aotearoa New Zealand. The Ministry supports Pacific languages with a number of funding streams, such as the Provider Languages, Community Languages and the Youth Languages Funds. Languages funding has been usually successful in raising awareness and increasing the use of Pacific languages. In 2020, the Community Languages Fund supported 344 community groups and reaffirms the government's commitment to ensuring that Pacific languages continue to thrive in Aotearoa New Zealand.
Question number 11, David Seymour.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance and reads as follows. Will Budget 2021 cut taxes for middle-income New Zealanders?
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker, Budget 2021 will continue the government's investments to secure the economic recovery and improve the wellbeing of all New Zealanders. In terms of specific policy areas that may or may not be in the budget, the member will have to wait just eight more sleeps. However, what I can say to the member is that we will not be adopting axed plans because it will require enormous cuts to public services like the winter energy payment that would hurt the most vulnerable in our society. However,
Order. I think the minister has answered the question.
Is the minister saying to New Zealanders that if they wait eight more sleeps, they might discover the budget will relieve them of the taxes he charges?
As I said in my primary answer, the member will have to wait to see the details of the budget. However, I can tell the member that we will not be adopting an ex-alternative budget that has been released because that would hurt the most vulnerable in our society and would diminish public services. But I do congratulate the member on repackaging his manifesto as an alternative budget and entrenching his position as the real leader of the opposition.
When the minister said that ACT's alternative budget would cut public services, could he point to one example he used to form that opinion?
I mentioned the winter energy payment in my comments, but the example I would say is that if the member wants to change the balance of income that the government gets, it will be unable to deliver the quality public services that New Zealanders rely on.
Andrew Bailey.
Will Budget 2021 impose more costs on small businesses?
Mr. Speaker, this government is very proud of its record of supporting small businesses all the way through COVID-19. Small businesses received support from the government, including the creation of the Small Business Cash Flow Loan Scheme. And I would invite the member to reflect on the fact that possibly for the first time in history, in the surveys done by MYOB during the 2020 period, the Labor Party got more support from small businesses than the National Party did.
Did the minister use winter energy payments as an example in his previous answer because he was aware when he gave the answer that ACT's alternative budget cuts middle income taxes by $1,200 to $2,200 while making no reductions to public services such as police, health, education, transport, fire,
or anything that would properly be considered a public service.
Any one of those 15 questions.
Mr. Speaker, no. The reason I did that was because I have real concerns as to whether or not ACT's alternative budget adds up, driven by the graph on page 8, where the member's just got his numbers plain wrong.
Betry. Does the minister really think that arguing about a graph is a substitute for giving New Zealanders no hope of tax relief while prices rise and he freezes the wages of the public sector?
Most of that question is wrong, Mr. Speaker, but what I do think is accuracy in these documents is important, and if the minister, a member wants any advice on that, I suggest he contacts Paul Goldsmith.
Does the Minister understands that while I'm asking the questions, he's answering to the people of New Zealand, and some of them would like to know if he's likely to cut their taxes.
As I said to the member, we have a long-standing tradition in this Parliament where the budget is given on Budget Day, and in the period leading up to that time, people are welcome to speculate. What I have said is this government recognises the importance of investing in public services, looking after the vulnerable, and there ain't no way his plan adds up to that.
So, that's a no.
Well, no, there's no, no, order, order, that's not a question.
Point of order.
A point of order, David Seymour.
Mr Speaker, I seek clarification. I thought the point of supplementary questions was to clarify previous answers, and it's been very difficult to understand what the Minister's trying to say. I just wanted to make it simple for him.
Well, let me deal with the first one first. I know members not that keen on being here, but there might have been a slight inflection at the end of the member's question, but it didn't mean it was in the interrogative. Simon Bridges, point of order. No. Number 12, Nicola Willis.
My question is to the Minister of Housing and asks, is the government on track to deliver the 800 Kiwi Build houses she estimated would be built in the 2020-2021 financial year? And will that include completion of the 176 Kiwi Build homes contracted by Kāinga Ora for construction by Ormiston Rise Development?
The Honourable Dr Megan Woods.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. The forecasted 800 Kiwi Build homes outlined to the member in the answer to the written parliamentary question 3946 on the 9th of March were on track for delivery in the current financial year. However, as the member is aware, the Ormiston Rise development was placed into receivership last Friday, and this does call into question whether these homes will be completed by June 2021. But I'd like to stress it does not necessarily call into question whether these homes will be completed. However, I do note that many of the purchasers of these homes were working to an October 2021 move-in date, and the latest advice I have is that expectations are still that the first homeowners will move in Q4 2021, that is between October and December 2021. I'd also like to take the opportunity to clarify a couple of points for the member. Firstly, since the answer to her written question was lodged, the number of Kiwi Build homes for Stage 1 at Ormiston has been reforecast to 173 because three properties were transferred into Stage 2 of the development due for delivery in 2022. And secondly, Kiwi Build does not contract homes for construction. Under the Buying Off the Plans programme, Kiwi Build provides underwrites to enable homes to be delivered by private developers.
Supplementary. Did she discuss additional financial assistance for Ormiston Rise with officials during the, quote, intensive discussions, quote, she had with them over the weekend and on Monday? And if not, what was discussed?
Mr Speaker, yes, I did ask officials whether or not there was any request from the receivers for additional financial support. Because of this development, 173 in Stage 1 are Kiwi Build homes, 190 of the properties are included in that stage. The answer that I got from officials is that the intensive discussions had actually been happening between officials and the receivers, not me. I don't get into either intensive or intense discussions. But what the terms of those conversations is that it was very clear that finance was not the issue or the reason why the receivers had been called in. In fact, finance is looking secure, and in fact, the financier has an equity interest in the development, so is therefore highly motivated to complete this development. I think what the member and all members of this House should be aware of is that many of these homes are very near completion. Many are very close to code compliance stage of development. So there is a lot of sunk cost, and everybody is highly motivated to realise the value and complete this development.
Supplementary. Well, if it wasn't financial reasons that meant the receivers were called in, what was the reason?
Order, order.
It's not this minister's responsibility.
She gave the answer.
She might have referred to it, but it's still not. Have a go.
Mr Speaker, I'm happy to talk to that because, of course, this is something that came up in discussions and something that I would have asked my officials of what that was. And the lenders and the financiers at Ormiston Rise became concerned about construction progress, and construction has been paused for a period of around 2 weeks for that progress to be evaluated.
Well, what does she say to the Kiwi Build buyer in the Ormiston Rise development who said, quote, "One of the reasons why we went with Kiwi Build is because it is run by the government. It should be safe," quote. And does she commit to Kiwi Build buyers in Ormiston Rise that their houses will be completed on time?
Mr Speaker, I've addressed many of the issues that the member raised in that question, but I am happy to answer it because that person has also written to me and I'm in the middle of writing a response to them. So what I can say to them is the government does stand behind this project. As I've explained to the member in a previous answer, that finance is not the issue, that finance is looking to be secure. And what I would ask that member is not to scaremonger for political purposes. There are a group of first home buyers that don't deserve for their anxiety levels to be taken up further.
Supplementary. Does she commit that the Kiwi Build homes and the Ormiston Rise development will be delivered on time?
Speaker, as I've intimated in previous answers that the members asked in this line of questioning, that we have had pauses to construction for a couple of weeks, although I haven't received official advice of what the delay might be. I would expect there will be a delay. When you do pause construction, that tends to occur. But as I said, the advice I have had is the first purchasers can expect to move into their properties in quarter four of this year. The expectation of most of the purchasers that I've been in communication was an October move-in date.
No, the members used all the supplementaries. That concludes our questions.